Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
I'd like to thank the people who support this program through their subscriptions, like Kathleen Emmer, Jeanette Annucci, Steve Wazensky, and Aaron Blair. If you haven't done it yet, sign up at peterbcollins.com. In the second portion of the podcast today, we're going to talk with Kevin Gostola about the state secret privilege. It's been used to gag Sybelle Edmonds and many other people and to keep Americans in the dark. And also, right near the end of this podcast, Will Durst checks in about legitimate and illegitimate rape and the ravings of Senate candidate from Missouri, Republican Todd Akin. Returning to our program today, investigative journalist, award-winning journalist, Gareth Porter.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Up on a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw plowing through the ragged skies and up a cloudy draw. Their brands were still on fire and their hooves were made of steel. Their horns were black and shiny and their hot breath he could feel. A bolt of fear went through him as they thundered through the sky. For he saw the riders coming hard, and he heard their mournful cry. Yippee-i-oh.
I'm sure Johnny Cash never expected that this tune, Ghost Riders in the Sky, would be used to talk about the use of unmanned aerial drones in far-flung portions of the world. And Gareth Porter has done some very important work analyzing the spin placed on those who have died as a result of our drone strikes that comes out of the Pentagon. Gareth Porter has covered these issues for many years, and let me say at the top here, Gareth, congratulations. This is the first time we've spoken since you were awarded the Martha Gellhorn Award for your journalism.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. I appreciate it. We haven't had a chance to talk since June, which is when I received the prize.
Yeah, well, and it is well earned, and as you know, I have great respect for the work that you've been doing covering many aspects of America's foreign policy and the impact that it has. And in a piece that you published at truthout.org on August 17, you have some alternate analysis of the casualty figures that come out of our government and that in some ways have been spun up by the New America Foundation and its national security expert, Peter Bergen. So first of all, the big picture here, we have heard accounts from our government that, carefully framed statements that zero civilians have died during certain windows of time when we were conducting aggressive and almost constant drone strikes, particularly in the rural portions of Pakistan. And we've also used them in Afghanistan and killed a number of civilians there. And Americans are being told that these drones are just so effective, no American lives are put at risk, and that we carefully target the individuals, and there is no collateral damage. That is fundamentally untrue, isn't it?
You are correct, Peter. It is fundamentally untrue, and in fact, it is ludicrous for the White House advisor to Obama on counterterrorism, John Brennan, to make that kind of claim, as he has done during the past year. And by the way, the claim has been repeated in a somewhat different context, a slightly different time frame being invoked by Peter Bergen more recently. That is to say, last month, he made the claim that the level of civilian casualties in drone strikes in Pakistan has gone to zero or close to zero over recent months. So both Brennan and Peter Bergen have made that claim at different times and in slightly different contexts, and both are equally false. We can safely say that because the only basis on which that statement is made is the now revealed policy of the Obama administration of considering any military-aged male in the strike zone who is killed by a drone strike to be a militant, so-called militant, mm-hmm. quote-unquote, a term that is never defined, but has been described, I think, accurately by one analyst as the weasel word of our present national security state with regard to drone strikes. It is simply a reflection of a dishonest, obviously convenient way of dealing with the problem of civilian casualties. And what I did in my story, Peter, is to really look at the first set of data, or two sets of data, on the civilian casualties in drone strikes that come directly from people who are in a position to know the truth. Mm-hmm. That is to say, in one case of 11 drone strikes, the families of the victims of the strikes, and in the other case, people who are from the locality who were eyewitnesses or who are aware specifically of the people who were killed in the strikes. In one case, the 11 cases that were gathered by the Pakistani lawyer for the victims, for the families of victims of drone strikes, in the other case, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism did research on 13 strikes, which were specifically chosen because they are known, it's documented that they were targeting either the mourners at funerals of people who were killed in the drone strikes, mm-hmm. or the rescuers in the cases of drone strikes where there were both killed and wounded, rescuers trying to to pull people out of the wreckage of the strike, were targeted by U.S. drones, and those 13 cases were the subject of research by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. So this is important because it's the first really significant data set that gives us something to compare the figures that have been put out by the New America Foundation, Peter Bergen's outfit, in their accounting for casualties of drone strikes, with data that comes really from people who are in a position to know.
And Gareth, you're on the go. I've caught up with you as you're mobile right now. And let me read a passage from your article that helps people understand the dimensions of this. Instead of representing only 30% of the total casualties of 11 strikes that were examined, civilian casualties actually accounted for nearly three-quarters of the total. And you go on.
That's right. That's in the case of the 11 strikes that involved the families of the victims actually stepped forward and said, we know who was killed. We can tell you the names and their positions, their ages, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very important piece of data.
And you go on to say the data on 13 drone strikes, the ones targeting funerals and rescue efforts reported by the BIJ, similarly contradict the NAF, the New America Foundation, tally of deaths. NAF recorded a total of 90 to 176 dead in 12 strikes. 77 to 153 of the dead were listed as militants, whereas only 13 to 24 were listed as civilians. But the eyewitness and other sources considered reliable say that between 80 and 107 civilians were killed in these attacks on rescuers or mourners. So at minimum, Peter Bergen is serving as an apologist for the Obama administration and putting a lowball spin on these numbers when, if he had done the kind of investigation that you have and sought some alternative sources, he would have come up with significantly higher numbers.
That's right. I mean, and the point that I would make here is that the methodology that Peter Bergen uses for his accounting of drone strike victims is one that relies entirely upon news media accounts, which are, you know, to a 90 to 95 or 96 or 97% degree, in turn reliant on sources that are clearly reflecting the line of the United States government with regard to the question of casualties. So it's like a sort of a circular process where we're, you know, we're talking to ourselves, where we're listening to news accounts that are based on the basically the official line on the casualties, and that is bound to be, clearly it's bound to be, as you say, in effect, a kind of apology for the U.S. drone strike program. And I would simply add one more point that I have, combining the two sets of data, the total 24 strikes, if you look at the NAF data versus the data that comes from the actual sources on the ground, what had been only 38% civilian casualties in the NAF data turns out to be 70% civilian casualties in the data from the actual original sources on the ground.
Yeah.
So it's a very dramatic change in the picture that we get from these data.
And it's worth repeating that this revolves around the torture definition of militant. And I would invoke Stephen Colbert's term here, truthiness.
Yes, exactly. That's a perfect way to put it, yes.
Because this is a way to whitewash things, to facilitate a misrepresentation of accurate information. And all of this, of course, is to sell drones as a new generation of warfare. And one of my beefs, and I recently spoke to Medea Benjamin, who's published a great new book about drones, and reveals quite a bit, and her work was done before the New York Times story was published in June. And, you know, what is frustrating here is that there has been no real debate about the use of this whole new wave of weapons. It's a new kind of warfare. And, of course, there is no debate about their insertion in areas where we have no authorization from a sovereign nation or the United Nations or some other international body. We are acting unilaterally, and I fundamentally believe that this is a form of terrorism, not really a form of warfare, Gareth Porter.
Well, it is a form of terrorism. I have no doubt about that, and I think that the United Nations Rapporteur on Human Rights understands that as well. I was a bit surprised to hear that the Rapporteur on Human Rights is demanding to see the video representations of these strikes, as though that would somehow resolve the question of whether they are legitimate or not. And I think that that it needs to be pointed out to the United Nations Rapporteur that the key to understanding whether this is a legitimate use of force or not is not going to be found in the in the video version of the event, but rather in the data that is provided by people who are families of the victims and who are eyewitnesses to the strike. And you're right that this is a fundamental problem of American democracy now. We have a new way of war that is being sold to the American people on the basis of a complete lie, which is that these are discriminating strikes based on, you know, almost perfect intelligence, which is not very, very far from the truth. The intelligence is very poor in Pakistan, as it is in Afghanistan. And, you know, I see a perfect parallel here between the lie that is told about the drone war in Pakistan and the war that has been the lie that has been told about the special operations war going into people's homes, breaking into two homes and taking people away, and in the process killing many civilians and claiming that these are not civilians but militants.
We also have a complicit Congress that is not interested in exercising its oversight responsibilities and has not conducted any significant debate about drone warfare. And I'll single out for some criticism my senior senator from California, Dianne Feinstein. She's coasting to a fourth term virtually unopposed this November. She chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee, and her reaction to the disclosures of the New York Times about what I have renamed the Kill or Kill program, because capture is rarely an option that is utilized.
Right.
Her response has been to try to crack down on where the leaks came from, and she seems satisfied that members of her Intelligence Committee staff are permitted to review some of the videotapes of drone strikes, and that suffices as oversight. When the real issue, as you just pointed out, is that we are just told to trust the sources of the information used to target these individuals who are all called terrorists, they're all lumped together as Taliban or Al-Qaeda, and we're relying on extremely unreliable sources like Pakistani military and intelligence forces, whatever intelligence apparatus there is in Afghanistan. And so this sanitized version of war that certainly does protect the attackers from any real paying any real cost in terms of human life visits destruction on the ground in ways that are sloppy, are you know, we cannot judge the credibility of the intelligence we're given, and more often than not we may be settling scores for the partisans in these different countries who supply the intelligence we use for targeting.
Absolutely. It goes on constantly. There's no question about that. And to go back to your original point that you made a moment ago about the Congress, from everything that I have learned in recent years, the U.S. Congress has degenerated continually over the last couple of decades to a new low, historically, in terms of responsibility, taking responsibility for oversight of U.S. Military forces and covert operations. I mean, this is the worst Congress ever. The unwillingness to question even mildly the way in which U.S. force is used, the way in which CIA has been carrying out the drone war, is a very, very serious challenge to American democracy, as well as to the interests of the American people. The fundamental interests of the American people are being ill-served by this. As I think most or all of your listeners already know, the drone war in Pakistan is the largest single cause of violent anti-Americanism. And by violent, I mean intense anti-Americanism in the Pakistani population. As many as 80% of the Pakistani population, according to opinion surveys, regards the United States as its number one enemy. And the primary reason, of course, is that the United States continues day in and day out, week in and week out, to kill civilians, along with a certain number of combatants, most of whom, by the way, have nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. This has nothing to do with the war on terrorism. It has to do 90%, I would estimate, with the war in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. The war in the drone war in Pakistan has become, long since 2009, an adjunct to the war in Afghanistan, a war that Americans overwhelmingly reject and believe should be ended. So, you know, the fundamental rationale of the Obama administration for this war is another huge lie.
And Gareth, let me see if you agree with this. I would extrapolate that in a nation like Yemen, which is essentially a failed state with a figurehead government that the U.S. rolls over at will, that the targeting information that we get in Yemen, where we may have spook boots on the ground, but we don't have a formal military presence, that we're even, you know, less certain of who the targets are and who's a civilian and who's a militant.
Well, I think there's no question that the situation in Yemen is, if anything, even dicier in terms of this question of who gets targeted and whether it represents, you know, genuine terrorist threat or simply a political enemy of the regime or of somebody locally who has the ear of U.S. intelligence. There's no question that that happens constantly, that targeting is skewed by the politics and personal rivalries that in which the United States inevitably gets caught up in a place like Yemen.
Mm-hmm. Gareth, you're also an historian, and you focused in great detail on America's war in Vietnam. And I was a young radio announcer during the final years of the Vietnam War, and I can vividly remember ripping copy headlines off of the UPI wire with the weekly body count from Vietnam. And we learned later that these numbers were highly spun, and that almost every week is in the so-called Vietnamization phase of Nixon's part of the war in Vietnam, that the numbers that they were reporting to Americans they were bullshit. Certainly, the death count of American soldiers was mostly accurate on a week-to-week basis. But the number of Viet Cong who were reported killed each week, those figures were often highly inflated. And again, they were designed for domestic political consumption, not any accurate representation of what was going on the ground.
Well, of course, this is absolutely true, and I would liken it to both the situation with regard to the drone war, but even more apt, I think, is the parallel with what has been happening in Afghanistan, where General Petraeus and General McChrystal, but particularly General Petraeus, have used figures that were released to the news media crowing about the number of Taliban insurgents who they claimed had been killed and captured, and I think I've been able to document with pretty convincing accuracy the degree to which those numbers are completely phony, and in fact that the vast majority of the people who were there claiming were Taliban who were captured during the Petraeus period were in fact civilians, and I've also documented, based on the figures that the U.S. military and NATO military put out in Kabul themselves, that as many as 1,500 civilians were killed in Special Operations Forces neck raids in less than a year, 2010-2011. And so I think the parallel is really quite apt, particularly between the Vietnam body count and the body count that has been put forward in Afghanistan.
And has Peter Bergen responded at all to your analysis, Gareth Porter?
Well, I sent him the excerpt from my piece that dealt with the NAF figures and pointed out that I would like to get his reaction to it. He wrote back and said, essentially, look, we put this out. We have been putting this out for 3 years. It's transparent. It's open to discussion. And when we make mistakes, we correct them. But as I pointed out in my piece, the most egregious errors, specifically one case where 83 civilians, basically young students in a madrasa, were killed in a drone strike in 2009, the NAF still continues to carry those 83 students as militants and has never corrected the mistake, despite the fact that a Pakistani newspaper published a complete list of all the names and all the ages, including as many as 21 young students who were under the age of 15 in their newspaper, and this was well known because it was a link that was included in the links that were. No, I'm sorry, it wasn't included. The newspaper was included, but the link itself is not included. But it was a very well known link, which the NAF chose to ignore in their accounting.
Mm-hmm. And Gareth, what other kind of reaction have you gotten to this piece? It's been out for about 4 or 5 days now, pro or con?
Well, I have not seen any critical reaction, although there may have been that I haven't. There may have been reactions that I haven't seen. But I was pleased to see that Chuck Spinney, who is blogging on the Battleland blog on, in Time Magazine online, did a very nice piece that cited my. My article on the drone war data as indicative of a failure of U.S. policy more generally. I think it's a very interesting analysis that he did based on my article, so mm-hmm. I recommend it highly to your listeners.
Great. I know your time is tight, and I want to respect that, but I want to turn to another area that you've been focusing on and that you and I have talked about at some length, which is Israel's increasing desire to launch a unilateral strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. And it's been fascinating to see the propaganda in the U.S. media, most recently using the attack at the Black Sea resort town in Bulgaria and treating it as a fact that this was a Hezbollah orchestrated assault on Israeli citizens. The Bulgarians still have not identified who the guy with the Michigan driver's license in the plaid shorts is and what his motives were. But in the same breath that Israel reported the incident that killed, I believe, six Israeli tourists, they immediately blamed Hezbollah, and that meme has now become fact in the American media, and I've seen several accounts where it is simply accepted that that's what occurred and that's who's responsible. And this is used as another cause for an Israeli attack on Iran, and that the U.S. should support it. And so I wanted to get your comment on that.
Well, sad to say, you're right. The U.S. media has overwhelmingly tended to go along with the Israeli take on Burgas, which was, you know, as many of your listeners will recall, Prime Minister Netanyahu immediately announced that the Iranians and Hezbollah were behind the killing of the Israeli tourists in the Bulgarian seaport bombing.
Mm-hmm.
And later, the next weekend, announced that he had, I believe, what he called rock-solid intelligence. Well, it turns out, we now know that that rock-solid intelligence consisted of an alleged increase in the total number of phone conversations, phone calls, between Burgas and Lebanon in the days prior to the bombing. And that was the rock-solid intelligence that told them that Hezbollah must be behind that bombing, which, of course, is an absolutely ludicrous claim in terms of cause and effect. Or intelligence for suggesting that that Hezbollah was behind the bombing. But I think I would make the point, I think more fundamentally here, that the claim that Israel is seriously planning to carry out or is even considering seriously the bombing of Iran is, in my view, misleading, because from the beginning of this phony crisis, the Israeli government of Benjamin Netanyahu has been talking about this military option, but has been using it systematically as a way of leveraging a shift in U.S. policy, particularly towards the Israeli view, and you know, with the idea that what they really want is for the United States to take care of the problem. And the reality, of course, is that the Israelis do not have the wherewithal to really prevent Iran from getting the weapons if they chose to do so, and that the Israeli military and intelligence knows very well and have said publicly that they agree with U.S. intelligence that the Iranians have not made a decision to go for nuclear weapons, and therefore talking about a strike at this point makes no sense. So it is my considered view that this is a bluff which is intended to influence U.S. policy, not a serious threat by Israel to attack Iran.
And Gareth, would you extend that to say that this is an attempt to meddle in the U.S. presidential election with the complicity of Mitt Romney, who went to meet with Netanyahu, and despite his pledge, not to diss the president while he's on foreign soil, the clear purpose of his trip and the rhetoric that accompanied it was to offer 1,000% support for Israel and to try to make it look like the Obama administration is tepid in its support of Israel?
Well, certainly that's a very reasonable thesis. I don't know if, in fact, that is what Netanyahu has in mind. There have been times when I was far more convinced that it was primarily or certainly to a high degree intended to influence the U.S. election. I'm now more convinced that it is primarily, certainly, to influence the policy of Obama, and I think it's because he now thinks that Obama's probably going to win, and that is probably a greater concern by on the part of the Israeli Prime Minister than trying to get Mitt Romney elected. But certainly, it was probably at one point much more a consideration for the Israeli government than it is today.
And I reported to my listeners the comments of Shimon Peres on his 89th birthday. In an interview, he deplored this whole idea of attacking Iran and talked honestly about the potential blowback. And there also have been reports from some Israeli military leaders about the consequences of an attack on Iran. Have you heard any other rational voices surfacing in this debate?
Well, I think that what you're referring to here is an overwhelming majority, an overwhelming consensus of the military and intelligence leadership of Israel, including both active duty and retired officials, who are aghast at the notion that Netanyahu would even be talking about that unilateral military option at all. And I think they regard him as a loose cannon, as somebody who is not exercising reasonable judgment, and who they just do not trust, basically. I mean, the former head of Mossad, particularly Meir Dagan, is very forthright, very critical in his assessment of Benjamin Netanyahu personally as a political leader. They simply don't regard Netanyahu as somebody who is exercising very careful judgment on a very grave issue. And I think to some extent they believe that he's playing politics in his threat or his talk about a possible threat to attack Iran. To some extent, I think they've said, I mean, Meir Dagan has said quite explicitly that Netanyahu is using this as a way of distracting attention from his policy towards Palestinian issues. That is to say, his refusal to come to terms, to try to come to terms with the Palestinians to create a Palestinian state, which I think most rational observers and most leaders in the Israeli military and intelligence circles believe is a necessary a component of Israeli security in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a very complex picture here in which I think that Netanyahu is very much alone in his, along with the hardline leadership of and followership of the party that he represents, which represents settler interests more than anything else. I think that the majority of Israelis, both leaders and the citizenry, are very much opposed to this whole idea of even talking about an attack on Iran.
Well, and the incredible irresponsibility at this point in time, Gareth, with the Middle East in such an unstable situation, with a hot civil war in Syria and a civil war that is smoldering in Iraq, changes in Egypt with the little flare-up on the Sinai Peninsula, and considering that on almost every border, Israel has some level of risk in terms of the future of its neighbors, to contemplate an assault on Iran and to downplay the likely consequences of that just strikes me as downright crazy.
Yeah, and I think, again, the military leadership is very well aware of that. And I did an interview with the former chief of the anti-missile program of Israel, Uzi Rubin, a former colonel in the Israeli military, who is still a leading figure in the defense universe in Israel, who told me that the Iranians are perfectly capable, now that they have improved the accuracy of their intermediate-range ballistic missiles, of turning out the lights and attacking infrastructure targets, which could create chaos in Israel. And he says, you know, I asked my military friends how they feel about trying to fight a war in the dark. So I think that's indicative of a very serious concern on the part of some key officials there about this issue.
Yeah. Well, Gareth, I'd love to talk to you further, but I want to respect your time, and I thank you for joining us today. And the place where I go to find all your reporting is at antiwar.com. Where I generally find your reports. Is there another website you want to direct people to?
Well, there's Counterpunch. There's Counterpunch. There's Common Dreams, and mm-hmm. several others. So lots of places where people can find my work.
All right. Gareth Porter, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Peter.
If you're a regular listener to the Peter B. Collins Show and the Boiling Frogs podcast series, you know that we're very concerned about the creeping police state developing in the United States. The rollback of our First, Fourth, Fifth Amendment rights. And the increasing assertions of state secrets.
Runs the religious, the hunted and weary, chasing the promise of freedom and hope. Came to this country to build a new vision, far from the riches of kingdom and gold. Like the Christians, some would burn the witches. Later, some got slaves to gather riches. But still, from near and far to seek America, they came by thousands to court the wild. But she just patiently smiled and bore a child. Once the ties with the crown had been broken, westward and saddle and wagon it went, until the railroad linked ocean to ocean, many the lives which had come to an end. While we bullied, stole, and bought a homeland, we began the slaughter of the red men. But still, from near and far to seek America, they came by thousands to conquer the world.
That's some music from a bygone era and from a constitutional crisis of the past. John Kay, the lead singer of Steppenwolf, is an immigrant to these United States, and that's a song he wrote at the height of the Nixon-Watergate constitutional challenge. And I believe that we are in a similar fix, and that people are even less aware today than we were back when Nixon was president. And joining me now is Kevin Gostola. He is a talented writer who's been delving into a lot of important issues. And I found his recent post at FireDogLake.com to be very interesting and instructive. Kevin, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Now, you've written a piece about the state secrets privilege. You call it a horrendous creation of the judiciary. I only know a little about your background, so share with our listeners. You've worked at Op-Ed News and you've written for a number of progressive blogs.
Yeah. Well, my big start is really I worked as an intern for about 6 months with The Nation magazine, and I was helping Greg Mitchell cover WikiLeaks, to keep up on that story. And then, you know, through that connection, I ended up actually co-authoring a book called Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Bradley Manning. And I've been traveling to Fort Meade regularly over the past month to cover that court-martial proceeding, a very important proceeding that goes to key issues around transparency and whistleblowing.
Sure.
And through all of these this effort, I've had the privilege of covering and being introduced to several other whistleblower stories, such as Thomas Drake, Sybil Edmonds herself, and John Kiriakou, and get to really understand what it means when somebody uses the words or the phrase war on whistleblowers, that it's not just an empty phrase that is some kind of left-wing platitude. It really has something behind it. This isn't something that's being conjured to get some kind of emotional reaction. And so I decided that after this FBI lawsuit was thrown out, this lawsuit against the FBI was thrown out involving informants and agents going into Orange County mosques, that it was time to look at the state secrets privilege and some of the history and background, because there's so many of these challenges to national security programs being mounted by lawyers or even citizens going to lawyers and asking for some help because they've had their civil liberties or rights violated, and then they are finding that they can't go anywhere with these cases because the executive branch of our government, the White House and the Obama administration right now, are using the state secrets privilege, just like Bush administration did, to prevent people from getting any sort of justice.
Well, and Kevin, just on a lighter note, you remember the movie Men in Black and that device that Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith had called the Neuralizer?
Yeah.
Well, I believe that our government tries to use the state secrets privilege as some sort of a neuralizer, as if, by claiming that something that is in plain view is secret, that we'll just say, oh, yeah, yeah, that's secret. We don't know anything about that. We're blissfully ignorant, and you know better than we do. So, Big Brother, you just take care of us, and we'll sit here like sheep and, you know, watch American Idol.
Right. Or maybe to stick with the movies here, maybe people who are listening have seen the film The Naked Gun, and Leslie Nielsen's character stands in front of a building that's on fire, and people are falling out of windows, and he's telling everyone that nothing to see here. And move along.
Right.
And that seems to be our government. And it is actually comical, which is why I would reference a comedy over, I guess, the other cliché mentioning might be the Star Wars films with the Jedi saying nothing to see here. But I think it's much more of a comedy at this point. And it's really tragic because of the impact that it has that they play these sort of games out in the open.
Well, Sybil Edmonds is traveling, as I mentioned, and is unable to be on this episode of our program. But it was through her, Kevin, that I learned the grisly details of how the state secrets privilege can be used and abused. And in her case, as she explains in her book, Classified Woman, and the book is still available, you can get the details at boilingfrogspost.com. In her case, it was used to retaliate against her and to preserve the no snitch rule in law enforcement agencies. And there she was at the FBI, hired after 9/11 as a translator. And when she found that there was a Turkish agent who had infiltrated her unit, who tried to recruit her to become a double agent, she did her duty and she reported it. And instead of being found credible and having this spy kicked out of the FBI translation unit, they cracked down on Sybil Edmonds. And her saga went on for years. It cost her hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees, and she kept hoping that through the courts, and if not the courts, through Congress, that there would be some accountability for the false use of the state secrets privilege assertion in her case. And instead, what we've seen is the architect of all that, Robert Mueller, got an extra 2 years as FBI chief without any debate, and despite the fact that the law clearly says that an FBI director can only serve a single 10-year term. So the collusion inside various branches of our government to crack down on people who are inconvenient, like Sybil Edmonds, is stunning. And it appears to be a game that is being played to win, and they are winning.
Right. I mean, I should also let your listeners know that Firedog Lake, which is the blog that I write and publish to right now as I'm a regular staff writer there, we did a book chat with Sybil Edmonds over her Classified Woman book. And I found it to be excellent, and led a chat with her couple months ago. And, you know, one of the things that I raised, and I've been raising consistently, especially as there's been this hysteria over leaks in Washington, D.C., it's that good government employees like Sybil Edmonds, Thomas Drake, John Kiriakou, Mark Phillips of the National Reconnaissance Office, you name them, are people who are doing their job. They're not radical people. They are doing what they believe they should do so that government can function. They are concerned with the impact of programs and policies on people. They're not promoting some ideological agenda. In fact, it's the opposite. It's the people who are suppressing them that are mounting ideological, egotistical, narcissistic, for their own purpose, agendas that go up against what Edmonds and other people are faced with. And I think it was stunning. And I really think one of the things that I should raise here on this call is a quote that I have before me from her book. I think it's really telling. Because at the end of the day, the state secrets privilege is really being invoked for the nefarious purpose of what Sybil Edmonds' supervisor, Stephanie Bryan, explained to her passive-aggressively as Sybil made this decision to go and take some action and bring it to the attention of superiors that she found corruption within the FBI. And what Bryan told her was, things work differently in government. While private companies are concerned with efficiency, security, and productivity, the government couldn't care less. Of course, the jobs here come with other pluses. Less work, more benefits, retirement. You need to know a little about some of the policies that are followed religiously in the FBI. Policy one, one for all for one. Policy two, problems and embarrassments are always swept under the rug, always. They don't want to know about the serious and embarrassing problems, no matter how scandalous. They don't want people reporting these types of issues and cases, especially on the record, in writing. And so that was the key thing that the FBI was faced with, and it's the key thing that all of these other agencies and government institutions are faced with when people, you know, try to expose the sort of corruption that is going on in our government.
And Kevin, to a person, every whistleblower who I have spoken with said, you know, I never considered myself a whistleblower. That wasn't my intention. I was doing my job as I had been instructed to do. And I recently interviewed Diane Rourke, who is a party to the Thomas Drake NSA case. She was a top staffer on the House Intelligence Committee and knew what was going on. Her client, the agency she was supposed to oversee, was the National Security Agency. And when Tom Drake revealed the difference between the two different software programs, one that didn't work, cost a bundle of money, and didn't protect the constitutional rights of Americans, versus the other that was far cheaper, I mean, by billions of dollars, and did have protections for Americans' Bill of Rights, you know, he was drummed out of that agency, and the retaliation against him was signal. And Rourke is, you know, a longtime insider. She served on the Hill for many years, and now she's on the receiving end of this retaliation, and she is stunned. But once again, you know, she had that insider's view and clearly knows how this stuff works.
Right. And certainly in the past couple of months, it's become evident that the government really doesn't want these insiders to be speaking to people, even after. I mean, in the aftermath of whistleblowers leaving, there are tremendous obstacles to actually being able to share your experience in government, even if you are now free from prosecution. I mean, the thing I wrote about also that has to do with Sybelle Edmonds is the pre-publication review process that she had to endure in order to eventually get her book published. It's something that everyone has to confront, unless you're writing about Osama bin Laden raids, and then you're okay,
right,
as we're finding out today with the Navy SEAL person who, in the news as we're recording this phone call, we're finding out didn't even go through the Pentagon's pre-publication review board, and this book is going to be coming out in a month.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can imagine the sort of things in it that whistleblowers would be retaliated against for publishing, and it looks like there could be a threat, but it's more of like saving face, because, and that's one of the things, as I'm going through a stream of consciousness here, that's been really evident and brought to the fore by the Obama administration and the way that they've handled people. It is so clear the differences between the people they crack down upon and the people that they don't crack down upon.
Indeed.
And it says a lot about the politics of the administration.
And one name that I'd like to add to our list here, Kevin, is Peter Van Buren. He is a courageous man. He's being drummed out of the State Department virtually as we speak. A 20-year veteran of the agency. He didn't ask to go to Iraq, but he accepted an assignment for a one-year tour to supervise some of the reconstruction projects. He published a book, We Meant Well. Not a shred of classified information in there. No hint of it. He survived the pre-publication review. And yet they're retaliating against him because it's embarrassing that we squandered tens of billions of dollars on ridiculous projects in Iraq. And he exposed that. And so we need to be clear that while many people look at state secrets and they immediately think WikiLeaks and Bradley Manning, and they assume the worst there, too, because of what Bradley Manning is accused, the most serious breaches are of merely secret information, nothing that is classified as top secret, and that contradicts an assertion the president himself made in a conversation at a fundraiser here in San Francisco a year ago, April. So even if you want to, you know, some hardliners, you know, believe that Bradley Manning is guilty of treason, I think he's a national hero. And I do have grave concerns about the way the court-martial will handle his case. But if you compare Manning and Van Buren deserves no retribution, no punishment whatsoever. And yet he is they're attempting to silence him, even though his book is out there and people know what's in it. And this is the insidious part. And it brings me back to that stupid neuralizer, which is, they are trying to, and they did this to Sybelle as well, they tried to classify information that had already been released after the fact.
Mm-hmm. I mean, definitely. And it really needs to emphasize, and maybe this isn't incredibly related to the state secrets privilege that's often invoked, but it definitely reinforces the sort of activity that the government undergoes while it's in the courts. And one of the things, I spoke to Van Buren myself as well, and one of the things he told me in the interview when I was taking down his comments was that, Kevin, you need to understand that you and I are actually committing an act of civil disobedience right now because I am not asking the State Department's permission to speak with you. So people need to understand that these employees of our government that just want to tell us what they're doing on a daily basis, that aren't about revealing classified information or state secrets, despite what the government would lead us to believe. They just want to tell us what they're doing in their day-to-day job. And I don't think it's reasonable for the government to argue that we should have millions and millions of people who have clearances and are in positions of government and aren't allowed to interact with the populace. I think that's a recipe for the sort of government corruption that enables things to go on, like torture, like spying, like warrantless wiretapping, like rendition, like the sort of things that are particular to the state secrets cases that have been pressed in the past decade.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, give us a thumbnail on the Orange County case, Fazaga versus FBI.
Right. So what appears to have happened with the Orange County case is that, and I come at this more particularly from the state secrets point of view, and how I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I should just preface my comment by saying, as far as I'm concerned, it really doesn't matter what the FBI was or was not doing in the mosque. They should have to answer for that in a court of law. And so for Judge Cormac Carney to give the federal government what they want and try to route this through a different avenue, which it appears now a lot of state secrets cases are being pushed through the FISA statute just because the judicial wants to do some weird go-around and not actually put the executive branch on the defensive. But what appears to have happened is there was an agent who was sent in, infiltrator,
right.
And his name was, I believe his name was Craig Montiel, and he was someone who would, you know, pretend like he knew all these people inside the mosque, and he'd make representations as if he was a friendly person, and, you know, the typical sort of infiltrator character, and these, you know, having figured out that he was an infiltrator, the leaders of this mosque wanted to have some semblance of justice, and they've put up with the FBI actually going into the courtroom and lying about what sort of actions they were involved in. And so I think that's really what's key that people should understand about this case, is that, you know, you really do have at the front end someone going in, and then now he's been the subject of articles. His name is Googleable. You can go find his story. And then in the courtroom, they challenged this infiltration, and the FBI wouldn't cop or admit that this sort of activity was being launched by them. And then, in fact, one of the staggering parts of the Carney ruling on this FBI infiltration in the last week was that he had, in fact, stood up in the courtroom before, or been in the courtroom before, and said that, you know, I'm not going to let you lie to me. You know, one of the things that is interesting is judges don't usually have a problem when you lie to the plaintiff, but if you lie to the judge, that's a big problem. And the FBI has actually lied to the judge in the history of this case, which people can look up more on. It's the Fazaga of the FBI.
And Kevin, we need to note here that the FBI posture kind of suggests that this is the first time they've done this. But we have a sordid pattern, and even the staid New York Times has established that in more than 20 cases, we have a paid FBI informant who is instructed to infiltrate a group, and more often than not, the informant goads or leads or suggests these people into committing crimes, sometimes concocting schemes for violent events. And from the Lodi Mosque case here in California to the Lackawanna Six in New York State to the schlubs in Miami who were going to blow up the Sears Tower and didn't even know that it's not called the Sears Tower anymore. and some of this would be laughable, except we have this pattern. And I happen to be old enough to go back to the last wave of exposed abuses of the FBI in the 60s and 70s. I covered the COINTELPRO issues related to the state-sponsored killing of a Black Panther leader in Chicago in 1969. And so these are issues that almost come full circle. But when we look at the modern-day efforts to keep these under wraps, we have the unprecedented use of the state secrets privilege. So take a moment here to help our listeners understand that this is not a matter of law. There has never been a legislated state secrets act in this country, at least not the one that they try to utilize in silencing these court cases. but it is an evolution of a series of judicial precedents going back to the 1950s.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, it's self-perpetuating in the same way that, you know, you could have politicians saying something about a policy and it just becomes accepted truth because nobody challenges it. And that's exactly the same way that it functions in the judiciary. So back in 1953, there was a case known as United States v. Reynolds. And what had happened is that the victims had family members that had died in a military plane crash. And the government wanted to say that if they were to hear this case in full, that there would be secrets that would be revealed. And so out of this, you had the state secrets privilege that became something that had its own force. And then we went through the decades until after in the new millennium, you had this instance where documents were declassified, and it showed that, in fact, the government had perpetrated a fraud on the judiciary and had lied about the content of the case, and there really wouldn't have been any problem at all with letting the case proceed forward. And so this has been used time and time again in order to prevent, and in my writing that I put together, I did a laundry list of the things that the state secrets privilege now makes it possible for the government to not only conceal, but also prevent from being held accountable for committing. So some of the examples that I can run down here is you can have racial discrimination in the workplace, or you can have sex discrimination. You can have workplace retaliation, such as in the case of Edmonds. You can have warrantless eavesdropping by the CIA, State Department, and any other government agency against government agents that are stationed abroad, and they don't have to answer for that. You can cover up extraordinary rendition. You can engage in the drugging and transportation of people to secret black site prisons, and there's nothing that the government has to answer for. You can have U.S. citizens placed on a kill list, and there isn't any way that you can have access to due process. So it's very, very egregious the way that this is being used. And I guess I would just close my comment about giving people sort of insight into the evolution of the state secrets privilege by just making it clear that it isn't really that important that the state secrets privilege exists in the end, because the big issue is how it's being used. I want people to focus on how it's being used. I mean, I think that it would be impotent if the judiciary would just say that you're not going to be able to bring this up, because I don't think it's unreasonable for the government, which operates secretly, to come before a judiciary and say, look, we've got these secrets and we don't want to present them. I think that's fully expected, especially if you think about how power functions. But in the way that our government is set up and the checks and balances, the judiciary is supposed to consider this to be a completely phony argument. And they haven't, been able or willing to stand up to it. And so, you know, what you have then is an entirely corrupt institution like the FBI can go on, and it can do things like warrantless GPS tracking, and and it can engage in various lawless practices, and it can entrap people, as you were talking about. Lots of infiltration of activist movements and suppression of dissent. Here, where I'm based in Chicago, there's 23 anti-war labor and international solidarity activists that the FBI has been used to go after and target for material support to terrorism.
Right.
And this sort of activity is just something that the state secrets privilege enables, because at no point do they have to answer for what they are doing.
Yes, and you know, one of the cases that you recap in your article is the one that is really maddening to me, and that is the case of Binyan Muhammad and four other co-plaintiffs who were renditioned, tortured, held at Guantanamo. And all of that is on the public record, including the torture taxi company that's owned by Boeing and based in San Jose called Jeppesen Data Plan. And so the idea, and it's important to underscore, that this case started under Bush, but when it was appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court here in San Francisco, it was in the early months of the Obama administration, and the judges were stunned when the government attorneys came in and reasserted the same arguments that had been presented under Bush and the final Bush Attorney General, Michael Mukasey. And they said, gosh, you know, did you actually talk to Washington? And the attorney there said, oh, yes, this is the Obama administration approved argument. And so it's really important for people to understand that Obama has not only extended the bad precedents that were established under Bush, he has aggressively moved to make them either even more draconian.
Yeah, I mean, that's correct. And in fact, has been really upset, as you can read. It's an establishment book, I'll admit that, but Daniel Clayman's work on killer capture really brings out how upsetting, how upset Obama gets when people like the ACLU lawyers and others raise any sort of stink about the implications of Bush administration policies and tries to challenge them in the court. And like you said, the Jefferson Data Plan case here, all of this is in the public record. And the treatment, the way that Binyam Mohamed was treated, I'll spare our listeners the sort of graphic things that he experienced, but people just need to know that this man was horrifically just defaced and maimed, and nobody should have to go through this. And then yet when you go to get some justice in the courtroom, you're denied because the judge lets the state get off with keeping secrets that are actually known. And one of the final points I'll make with this case is that it actually becomes a kind of corporate secrets act, because Jefferson Data Plan isn't a government institution or agency. I mean, it's a contracted company, mm-hmm. and yet the government gives them cover in the, you know, incestuous relationship that government and corporations often tend to form in this day and age.
Well, and Kevin, I want to underscore the duplicity of Barack Obama personally, because on the one hand, he serves up this little happy talk line of how he wants to look forward and not backward. But in this case, he not only has enabled the cover-up of torture programs that are not covered up, he has essentially denied access to the courts of individuals who have been egregiously wronged. These are not people who, you know, lost a few minutes held in detention while somebody asked them questions. These are people who lost significant portions of their lives in miscarriages of justice, including the barbaric torture, and you were too polite to mention it, but Binyam Mohamed had his genitals cut 10 or 20 times, and then they poured some sort of a hot liquid or an acid on the open wounds. That is how degenerate the treatment of him was, and that is what Barack Obama sees a need to cover up on behalf of his predecessors. And I cannot fathom it. I can't rationalize it. And I can't sit still and be quiet just because Mitt Romney is worse than Obama and not call out what I consider to be, you know, a major moral failing and an abuse of our criminal justice system.
I mean, what you're getting at here, and this is something that I've been covering a little bit in my writing, is that it's the entire political system. It's both parties that actually make this possible. They're enablers. I mean, think back to how difficult it would have been to convince any Democrat during the period between 2006 and 2008 that they needed to even go out and fake outrage at Bush administration crimes and suggest that, you know, any of the people in the Bush administration be held accountable for the sort of torture or rendition that was being undergone. And then take it a step further and think about the incredible, what happens when you have Obama going out there and invoking the state secrets privilege is that you're, in effect, decriminalizing torture because nobody is being held accountable. Nobody in the CIA, nobody in the FBI, nobody except for maybe a low-level soldier at Abu Ghraib is going to be held accountable for torturing an individual. That is the state that we are in as a country because of the indifference that the administration has shown towards actually assessing and bringing to light the sort of activities and policies that the Bush administration carried out, and to also even admit that they themselves continue these policies, that in many ways they get around, they may not be doing some of the most barbaric aspects of the Bush administration's policies any longer, but you still have the way that Guantanamo is set up. You now got attorney clients not being allowed to have conversations with one another unless the Guantanamo commander says they can talk to each other. And you've now got, you have the case with the CIA torture tapes that were destroyed.
Right.
And yet the ACLU wasn't able to get anywhere to have anybody held in contempt for that.
And Jose Rodriguez was allowed to publish his bestseller without any interference from pre-publication review, while John Kiriakou is being, affirmatively and aggressively prosecuted. And it's always rough to, offer moral comparisons. I think it's definitely wrong to deny Binyam Mohamed access to American courts. But for Obama, 3 years after the fact, to go after this CIA officer and try to retaliate against him as a way of sealing the denial of waterboarding from years past is again deeply offensive, and it's so hard to compare them. But to single out an officer from the CIA, an American citizen, and treat him in this manner, trying to punish him, it just is off the charts. I guess words fail me, Kevin.
Right, right. And then I guess I'll take it a step further and move us into the one area that we haven't gotten to, which is that the judiciary will actually look to the executive branch, knowing full well that they're covering up abuse, and say, well, you could investigate it yourself. If you know that these people have been violated, you can hand out claims. And they make the comparison to the fact that there were reparations handed out to Japanese Americans who had been abducted and interned in camps during World War II. And I guess, that's fair. The government could potentially help these people. I think it's true that the Obama administration could take a step to compensate people. But then in that case, you would have to question why we even have a judicial system in this country. I mean, if we're going to operate under the assumption that the executive could voluntarily police itself and voluntarily decide that it's being unjust at any moment, then we could get rid of the courts. And obviously nobody is going to stand and argue that there should be no court system. So what we have to just agree upon is that the judiciary is not doing its duty, and people need to understand that this is something that they should not be silent about, because it has incredible ramifications for the country, and you have this incredible descent, and I don't think it's an exaggeration to say a descent into despotism, because that is, in effect, how much power they have allowed to be aggregated in the hands of the executive, that anybody who gets into that position can do just about anything to advance the policies and promote American superpower here or abroad.
Well, Kevin, I think you've done a great job of analyzing these issues, providing some historical background, and I really appreciate the work that you're doing there, and I hope you will keep it up. And I'm going to recommend, I'll link to your article in the show file, at both peterbcollins.com and Boiling Frogs Post. Kevin Gonzola, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And now, no further delays, stand-up comic from San Francisco, Will Durst, wants to share a few remarks about Todd Akin, the would-be Republican senator from Missouri.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here, working like crazy to find the humor in Missouri Senate hopeful Todd Akin's recent celebrated claptrap. Now, normally, rape and funny live in two different solar systems whose orbits rarely, if ever, intersect. Systems with significantly different trajectories and fields of gravity, if you catch my drift. But this guy's idiotic remarks are the exception that proves the rule, winning him in one fell swoop that Joe Biden, foot so deep in his mouth he's probably tickling his spleen with his shoelaces, Lifetime Achievement Award. During a television interview, the Republican congressman told the reporter that what he understands from doctors, women who are legitimately raped don't get pregnant. Wow. Where do you start? Legitimately raped. Suffice it to say that no qualifying adverb is ever necessary in front of that particular noun, especially from a man. And what kind of doctors is he hanging out with? Do their white jackets have long, long sleeves that wrap around the back where they're buckled real tight? And this guy is a member of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology? Hope he's concentrating on space and technology. Republicans needed to reignite the war on women right before the national convention, the same way a fireworks factory needs a grease fire on July 3rd. Meanwhile, an oblivious Akin is trying to walk back his comments, and the GOP is trying to walk him back over a cliff. They must have realized that misspoke was not going to cut it this time, because the entire party rented jetpacks to fly away from the radioactive congressman as far and as fast as possible. But the Tea Party favorite uncompromisingly refuses to quit. And Democrats across the nation are shouting themselves hoarse, fanning the flames of this conflagration, while at the same time whispering words of encouragement, hoping this symbol of ignorance exercises his God-given right to remain stupid in public. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
Thanks for joining me today. I hope you'll continue to fight with us to restore our constitutional rights. It's an ongoing struggle.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.